the interest rates that you have access to at the time of your loan are dependent on so many factors like your credit history, federal interest rates, the size of your loan in general. And of all the factors that go into calculating what interest rate you get, you control like a handful of them.
Right.
Credit history, maybe timing, but the timing thing really only counts if you're talking about planned expenses like mortgages or student loans. For certain kinds of debt, like medical debt, there's not a great way to predict when an ache or a pain is going to translate into this giant hospital bill. Welcome to the Rich and Regular podcast presented by Success, where we explore life at the intersection of money. I'm Kirsten.
And I'm Julian. Today, we're going to talk about shame and debt.
Ooh, Holy Spirit, activate.
I don't know that song.
What?
I have no idea.
It's like it's been on TikTok and IG for like the last 3 weeks.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, no, I don't know that song. I'm showing my age, but I'm okay with that. This is a really sore topic and a very real one, right? You know, I think if this were Family Feud and we asked 100 people to name one word that best describes how debt makes you feel, I'm willing to bet the number one answer would be shame.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is funny you say that because the Holy Spirit Activate song was from Family Feud.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, see, I am tuned in, you know? I'm tuned in to what the cool kids are doing.
No, you're not.
No, you know that saying, ignorance is bliss? I just think it's like 100% accurate when it comes to dealing with debt. Because like when you're ignoring it, or if you don't know how much debt you're in and you're just sort of floating through life, that can truly be like one of the best experiences ever. But it's not until you confront it and you start building out a plan to eliminate it that like things get a little heavy.
Yes. Like, not like weighted blanket heavy, that feel good heavy. It's like when you try to lift a toddler in the middle of a tantrum, a different kind of heavy.
Yeah.
And I think this is a good topic because we recently talked about credit being one of those topics that adults rarely revisit their opinions on. Mm-hmm. And I feel like debt is sort of its kissing cousin.
Okay.
Which is such a problematic phrase. Like, who invented kissing cousins?
I don't know, but you probably need to stop saying it.
I know. Don't cancel me, y'all. Not yet. But I think the reason why people don't revisit what's changing with credit is because they also haven't revisited their point of view around debt to begin with.
Yeah.
So I'm also really happy to dig into this episode on the back end of last week's episode.
Yeah. So let's do it. Let's jump right in. I want to first start talking about why debt feels shameful in the first place. And I'm sure there are listeners who feel like we're going to like jump right into critiquing a popular personal finance personality. Like, I'm sure there's some people who are like, ooh, they're getting ready to talk smack about such and such. I'm not. Yet. Yeah, we're gonna get there. I will eventually, just not right now. But I think, you know, when I think about even, so I'll just sort of go back in time and tell a little bit of my own story here. When I think about where and how I grew up, and we've spoken about this quite a bit on this podcast and on pretty much every other platform that we've ever shared our personal story on. I grew up in poverty. I grew up in Brooklyn, New York City. It was tough back in those days. It was not the feel good. You know, millennial friendly, diverse Brooklyn that people know today. It was really, really bad. And one of the things that I ended up getting caught up in as a kid and as a teenager was stealing. And I won't get into why I did it as a kid. But it's something that I'm certainly not proud of. It's something that I am mindful of. And for a long time, I felt shameful about it. But as I think about who I stole from, like, I started to notice something. And depending on the situation or the person, the feeling wasn't shame at all. Like, in some cases, what I was feeling would be more described or best described as guilt, which really led me to like thinking about it and exploring like what the differences are between the two. So I found this article that I thought cleared up the difference in a pretty concise way. And it's from www.verywellmind.com. The author is Kristalyn Salters Pernault. I could be mispronouncing that last name. It could be Pernault. But either way, she wrote this article. And in the article, she said, when you feel guilty about the wrong thing you did, you can take steps to make up for it and put it behind you. But feeling shame or being convinced that you are the thing that's wrong offers no clear-cut way to come back to feeling more positive about yourself.
Yep.
So basically what she's saying is shame is like an all-encompassing feeling. It's a feeling in reference to who you are completely as a person, whereas guilt is like related to a very specific action, something that you did that you may not necessarily be proud of, but you don't believe fully defines you. And so in my case, you know, I've stolen before. It's something that I'm not proud of, but I've never like identified as a thief.
Right.
Right. Or like a morally corrupt person. And that's not to say that I also don't hold myself accountable for what I did, but I just sort of compartmentalize it a little differently. And I think when it comes to money, while I've been in debt, very similarly, I've always seen it as my circumstance or a point along a journey, but not like this defining characteristic.
Yes, yes. That's very like enlightened of you to point out the differences between shame and guilt. And, you know, my fellow Texan, Brené Brown, kind of built her career off of studying the differences and talking about vulnerability as like the cure for all of it.
This might sound sexist, but is there like a male Brené Brown? Is there a Brené Brown for guys?
Wouldn't it be Simon Sinek? Start with Y?
Maybe. It's not like specifically focusing on the same subject matter.
Yeah.
I don't know much about Brené Brown, but I know she's all about like vulnerability.
Yeah. Well, she's a research storyteller. Malcolm Gladwell might be.
Okay.
The male version.
Okay.
Of Brené.
I mean, I like Brené Brown, but you know.
Well, let me get her quote out.
I'm not going to a conference.
I like her definition of shame because she says that shame is the intensely painful feeling or experience of believing that we are flawed and therefore unworthy.
Mm.
So it kind of speaks to that all-encompassing feeling that you're talking about and how quickly it can become an identity. Because you have this heaviness, this weight to yourself, you also feel like you don't deserve anything good in the world or anything at all.
Yeah.
And what I found is that one of the defining characteristics of people who are kind of immersed in shame is a bunch of shoulding, meaning a lot of I should, I should have, which is basically an indicator that you're still fighting with reality.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, something happened. For example, you needed a loan to afford to go to college. And instead of that being a standalone fact, a thing that happened, you kind of get stuck in what you should have done.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I should have gone somewhere cheaper. I should have known better. And one of my mentors used to say, where there's a should, there's some shame.
That's a really great quote.
I know.
But she came up with that on her own?
I don't know. You know, I tried to Google it to see if she had maybe stolen it from somebody, but nothing came up.
Hey, I need to
trademark that. So I might need to attribute it. What I sometimes say, where there's a should, there's some shame.
Yeah, it definitely sounds like a Southern woman saying.
I know.
Yeah, so whoever she is, I'm pretty sure she's from the South somewhere. It's a really fascinating subject because I had not thought about the distinction between the two. Willing to bet that a lot of our listeners have not either. And so I would encourage you, if you are struggling with shame, to sort of dig into that a little bit. There are tons of articles online. I just happened to mention one, and we'll link to that in the show notes. But it's certainly something that I thought was interesting. And I think if you think it's interesting, do some research. That'll be a little Sunday afternoon research for you. I think it's so important, though, to sort of understand that distinction specifically as it relates to debt. And with that said, I found another article. This one's from Bankrate.com, and it was about the average American debt. And basically, they said the average American debt is about $98,000, which compared to the average income, which is just over like $31,000 in the United States, sounds really out of balance.
Yeah.
Borderline horrifying. But if you think about that in terms of shame, right? I mean, you might say that there's a strong possibility that hundreds of millions of people feel deep shame and worthlessness about their debt, right? And if that's true, then like we could be on the brink of a public mental health crisis, right? Like going back to the original article, the writer noted that shame and low self-esteem left unchecked or untreated can lead to like more destructive behaviors like substance abuse, road rage, domestic violence, eating disorders, and all kinds of other personal and social crises. And again, I don't want to sort of take this to the next level, but I think a lot of these things are certainly related, right?
Yeah.
People are sort of rolling the dice and saying, you know, what do I have to lose? Because it's all going to come crumbling down at some point. And so it sort of just builds and builds. And so unbeknownst to me, I think it's safe to say that the debt that we're in isn't just sort of like a, you know, closed monetary or financial issue. It really is a sort of public safety, a public health issue, and certainly has the potential to be a significantly worse issue. The risk of what debt can have in terms of the impact on society is not something that surprises me. Mm-hmm. And I'm actually really grateful that we sort of connected these dots, because I think it really affirmed our approach. We've made a very deliberate decision on this podcast, from our blog to even just the way that we tell stories and talk about money, to not just focus on the how-to.
Right.
And the reason for that is because, one, I think there are tons of resources out there that are showing you how to or what to do. Press this button, this is what will happen on the other side. But there aren't nearly as many resources out there that really lean into the social and the cultural aspects of money, which most people who talk about money will admit that's actually the hard part. The easy part is sort of knowing the differences, knowing that the IRS just raised, you know, contribution limits year over year, and as a result, this is how much more you can contribute. The hard part is sort of how those things sort of rub up against everyday life and impact the way that we live our lives. So I was really affirmed by that, but it doesn't sort of take away from the concern. But I do think it sort of highlights that issue here, is that we can't teach ourselves out of the mess that we're in. No course or book about understanding finances or money, or certainly no glossary that helps people understand terminology, is going to help get us out of the situation. I think it's far more complicated than that.
Yeah. And I'm glad you connected those dots between debt and a public mental health crisis, because although Brené Brown didn't study debt, she did do tons of research on shame. Mm. And after years of research, what she found was that shame was actually the single biggest cause of toxic masculinity. So when you talk about issues like substance abuse, road rage, domestic violence, know that for men, becoming consumed with shame for showing signs of weakness leads to toxic masculinity.
Yeah.
Women experience shame when they fail to meet these unrealistic, conflicting expectations. But men, it absolutely leads to destructive behavior, because it's not an emotion that burns clean. Shame kind of metastasizes like a cancer.
Yeah.
And so when you think about interpersonal relationships and even heteronormative romantic relationships, if men and women are experiencing this emotion in different ways, it's really difficult to find a common ground to have a productive conversation about how to move past it. And it's certainly more difficult to like narrow it down to maybe debt is the core reason why we feel this.
Yeah. Listen, I am having so many flashbacks right now to conversations that I've had with other men, conversations that have been artfully avoided with other men. And I've always sort of suspected, you know, that some of these issues that a lot of them were sort of having were kind of tied to money, right?
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily caused by money, but certainly money or debt or, you know, low income or some of these other issues certainly played a role in why all of the other aspects outside of their life seem to be falling apart, but they didn't really want to talk about the money part because there's such a taboo associated to how much people make or how much debt that they have. And so that's why we're having this conversation, because we're hoping it can at least help to inspire other conversations, or for people to do their own research and to dig into their own personal well-being, or maybe just help another person who might be struggling with this. I want to dig into that number a little bit. So we spoke about what the average debt is in the United States. That same article actually broke that number down. And so the average credit card debt is around $5,000, to be specific, was $5,315. The average personal loans was around $16,000. The average auto loan comprised just under $20,000. The average student loan was around $38,000, $39,000. And then this one was actually a surprise to me. The HELOC, which is an acronym for Home Equity Line of Credit, that was around $42,000. And then the average mortgage was around $208,000. And so that's essentially what the debt picture looks like. I think they stripped away a couple of other things, because that's certainly a little bit more than $97,000. I don't know exactly how they came up with that number, but that is what the average sort of debt looks like, broken out by categories. And to me, while those numbers are high, like knowing what I know now, I can say with confidence, or even with a bit of moral conscience, that people should not feel shame or guilt about that. I think without context or details, it's hard to say. But even if we did learn that someone was irresponsible, and that was a major contributor to what led them there, I just still can't justify shaming them. So first of all, like I'm not in any position to do so. And secondly, I don't know how much they earn. So if you earn $100,000 and you're in $100,000 of debt, I mean, that's still a lot of debt, but I mean, it's probably a lot more manageable than if you, let's say, earned closer to the average amount of income, around $31,000. Because in that position, like, it can really spiral out of control pretty quickly. And that's not necessarily a function of you doing something wrong. And even if you did do something wrong or fail to sort of read the fine print or fell into a predatory loan, that's not, you know, a reason, I think, to for you to be shamed, and certainly not a reason for you to feel ashamed.
And I think the challenges with averages in countries that have such income inequality like the United States, where it's just like there's such outliers that can skew the average either way.
Right.
Like the average mortgage of this room might be $150,000. But if Bill Gates walks in, the average mortgage is now $3 million just because a billionaire stepped into the room. So I think that's part of the challenge. But what also makes this conversation really tricky is that the terms of the debt dictate how high the mountain that the person who needed it needs to climb.
Absolutely.
So an auto loan that has a decent interest rate spread over 7 years might be manageable, but a private student loan where the interest accrues daily at a much faster pace than wages may could take 5 decades to pay off, or maybe not even be able to be paid off. And if you think about interest rates, they're really just the cost of borrowing money, but the interest rates that you have access to at the time of your loan are dependent on so many factors like your credit history, federal interest rates, the size of your loan in general. And of all the factors that go into calculating what interest rate you get, you control like a handful of them.
Right.
Credit history, maybe timing. But the timing thing really only counts if you're talking about planned expenses like mortgages or student loans. Mm-hmm. For certain kinds of debt, like medical debt, there's not a great way to predict when an ache or a pain is going to translate into this giant hospital bill.
So, you know, this one hits close to home because I have family members that were really caught up in medical debt. Mm-hmm. And basically, you know, it was a fluke situation. He had a condition. He did not know he had it. Things got bad really, really quickly. He was sort of rushed into surgery. And before you knew it, he was there for, you know, a couple of weeks. You know, bills don't get paid. You're missing out on work.
Oh, absolutely.
You know what I mean? You get that giant bill. And by the way, it's never just one bill. You get one bill and then you get two, three, and it just keeps on coming. You can't pay it. You can't keep up with it. Credit card bills sort of stack on top of that.
Oh, yeah.
And before you know it, like, he was in 6 figures of debt and he's still struggling with that. And this was almost 10 years ago.
Oh, yeah.
It's like getting in the way of almost everything, like his ability to send his son to college, obviously his ability to own a home, his credit, like all of those things are sort of just due to having a fluke medical issue and quite reasonably not being able to pay it all in such a short period of time. There's just very few Americans who can afford to pay 5 figures worth of medical debt or carry that loan on a credit card on top of all of the other responsibilities that they may have.
And medical debt is one of those domino effects where it's like if somebody's down for the count, the bills associated with parking at the hospital, feeding yourself, staying in hotel rooms, eating out more out, like it all just begins to accumulate. And to your point, if you're not working, it goes on a credit card.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't even say that we're underinsured, but we do have a high deductible insurance policy, which means that while our monthly premium is lower, we pay more healthcare costs before the insurance starts to chip in with their share.
Yeah.
And so we're even at risk for this because in our case, our out-of-pocket max is almost $14,000 a year. So playing out a worst case scenario, let's say you end up in the hospital on December 20th.
Well, I got to end up in the hospital.
I was going to say me, but I didn't want to put that out there.
It's going to throw me in front of the
bus. Yeah, let's just say you. I'm not saying it's something serious. Maybe you tore an ACL or something.
That's pretty serious.
Okay, well, you end up in the hospital for a little less than a month. You go in on December 20th and you don't get out till January 13th. You miss Christmas and New Year's.
You planning this out.
I said worst case scenario.
All right, for the listeners, if I'm down for the count, this is the audio recording that this was not an accident.
Here's my point. We would pay up to $14,000 out of pocket for the time that you're in there in 2021. And then our insurance resets.
Yep.
And we pay another $14,000 for the 13 days that you're in there for 2022. So that's $28,000 in 30 days over Christmas.
Yep.
And while we're well off, very few people are equipped to manage an unexpected expense like that. We would need to make some moves.
Yeah, I'd have to shuffle a couple
things. Yeah, we'd have to shuffle a couple things. I don't know what we'd have to do. Like, I should play this out, take my own advice and play this out. But like, it's crazy.
And hospitals know this, which is why so many of them have programs that either forgive debt or they're like willing to work with you on a payment plan or something.
Mm-hmm.
It's so pervasive, right, that we have these systems in place because they know that it just happens and you have to have somewhere to sort of offer support for people. So for our listeners, if you're looking for a practical way to protect yourself from predatory practices while we're on the subject of medical debt, we have a book recommendation for you. It's called Never Pay the First Bill. The writer is Marshall Allen, and they are published by Portfolio, which is our imprint on Penguin Random House. The book Never Pay the First Bill is a guerrilla guide to healthcare the American people need. And in it, he reveals the industry's pressure points and how companies and individuals have fought overbilling, price gouging, insurance denials, and more to get the care they deserve.
I will say, this is anecdotal, so readers, listeners, do this what you will. Do with this what you will. Do with this what you will. Is that how it goes?
Yeah.
Anyway, so my cousin had back surgery a couple summers ago.
Okay.
And as a result, the family hit their out of pocket max in like July. And so they made it like middle-aged Christmas. Because, you know, once you hit that out-of-pocket max,
everybody
you can start hitting them
something.
Up for all the electives, surgeries, and procedures. So it was like, do y'all need anything? You can get a vasectomy, a mammogram, whatever you want. So if you do hit your out-of-pocket max, just have like a wish list of some of those things that you've been putting off because you didn't want to, you know, pay for them out of pocket.
Yeah, I'm married into the family of fraudsters.
It's not fraud.
Good to know.
Anyway, we'll be right back after a word from our sponsors.
Okay, so we're back. I said I would get to discussing particular personal finance media personalities in the beginning of this podcast. I think now is a pretty good time to jump into that. This disclaimer, we're not slinging mud. We are trying to zero in on this conversation with respect to shame and as it relates to debt. We've been in the personal finance and media space, well, I think as bystanders for over 10 years, but as personalities, for lack of a better word, for the greater number of about 4 or 5 years. And one of the things I've certainly noticed has not just been a changing of the guard. And by that, I mean there are larger, more established, wildly popular and successful platforms that are led by certain individuals who I think have really leaned into shame, right, as the sort of primary motivator to get people to make better financial decisions. I'm sure you know at least some of those voices, but the big three that I'm thinking of or speaking of, the first I would say is David Bach. The second I would say is Susie Orman. Mm-hmm. And the third, dare I say, most notorious with respect to shame would be Dave Ramsey.
Dave Ramsey,
yeah.
That's stupid tax.
With the stupid tax, right?
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on this? Or those sort of three personalities and their respective approach to kind of using shame as a way to actually motivate people?
Yeah, I've listened or read or studied all of them, especially when I was paying off my debt. And I used to listen to Dave Ramsey's podcast almost every day for years while I was paying down my debt. And there, I will say there's something to like his formulaic paint by numbers approach to debt payoff, which are these baby steps, do this first, second, third, fourth, all the way up to seven. And at that time, I didn't mind his tone because that's what I needed at the time, or at least that's what I thought he needed. He was loud and authoritative and simple at a time where I just didn't trust my own voice due to a lot of the things that we're talking about around shame. But when I finished paying off my debt, I found his advice less and less helpful.
But was it his advice or was it his tone?
It was probably both.
Okay.
And I don't even know that it changed or if I changed, you know, going back to the episode we did about outgrowing your financial heroes. I don't know who changed, but I just found it less and less helpful. I was at a place in my life where I felt empowered And I didn't like the one size fits all advice. I felt like it was absent of cultural contingencies around, you know, what to do if you're Black or don't have access to the same resources. But his voice was stuck in my head like a bad song due to all the algorithms. So because I had listened to him for 2 years, YouTube would serve up his stuff, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. It was everywhere.
You start to think it sets the tone.
Yeah,
for
I start thinking maybe I'm crazy because
as a
this
whole.
Voice is everywhere. So maybe I'm being rebellious and like missing something. But anyway, at the end of the day, I do think that Dave and those like Dave know who their core audience is. I'll focus on Dave. I think he knows who his core audience is. There's a reason why his courses and programs are distributed and very popular in churches.
Yeah.
One, because it's an easy way for all his pastor buddies to generate some extra revenue for the church, which is a different topic. But two, because he knows that tying debt freedom to religious obedience, his programs are going to get better results for those people, right? He knows that teaching debt as a moral failing, as opposed to this kind of Swiss Army knife tool that can be used in a bunch of different situations, is very effective for some. Just like there are some people who believe that abstinence is the best form of sex education.
Right.
I think the reactions from other voices are people that just aren't his audience.
Yeah.
Right. And I think because he has such a big voice in the space and because he has such a chokehold on the algorithm, they have a right to be heard as well, to tell people that there is an alternative to this methodology.
Yeah. I have mixed thoughts on the old guard and Dave specifically, or I should say Dave Ramsey and the other personalities. We know some of them, right? We've, you know, pretty close with some of them. I have mixed thoughts on it. But I do agree with you. I think, you know, as someone who has had debt, who's read several of those people's books, watched them, I've heard them speak live, I don't think it's completely fair to define them by like the notion that they just shame people as a primary way of motivating them, right? There's a lot that they do. I don't know that that's one thing that you don't necessarily, or that some people don't particularly agree with them, should be the thing that sort of defines their entire body of work. And I know that rubs a lot of people the wrong way, because, like, you know, especially today with like cancel culture, it's like, if you've done one thing and that one thing is something that somebody is passionate about, everything that they've done, every good deed, every program, book, throw it out the trash, wipe it away. Let's pretend that it doesn't exist. I think that's dangerous. And I think we need to be a little bit more sort of mature about some of the things that they do well and some of the things that they don't. I think to your point, it's clear that for some people, you just may not be your cup of tea. And I don't think that there's anything wrong with that. But I would also ask, I think, the more critical question, which is whether or not he or they or personalities like that are effective. And I think that the answer to that question is undoubtedly yes. Like, they have huge followings. There's a reason why that approach seems to work. And, you know, to your point, he's partnered with churches, but even beyond churches, like world-class businesses that we celebrate, organizations around the country, and his message and style of sort of delivering that message works for those people. And so I think the more accurate critique may simply be that his ability to use shame as a motivator is precisely what some people need to improve their financial life or to improve their financial life at a particular point in time. And for everyone else, it's a turnoff. And it can absolutely be a turnoff. I would say for me at this point in my life, it's, I don't need it. But it's just like unnecessary.
Yes.
It just feels like a whole bunch of extra sort of shaming and borderline bullying that I just don't really have a need for or find any real value in. But I'm certainly not going to disregard anything or sort of all of the impact that he has had. And I would say, even aside from Dave Ramsey, when you think about Susie Orman, who had her own sort of style of no, you can't, or denied, or I forget what she used to do on her show, or David Bach, who at this point, like,
the latte factor.
Gosh, man, like, that's it's kind of sad, honestly, because at the time it was a really, dare I say, groundbreaking way of looking at how simple it could be for people to save money that could have a long-term impact.
Yeah, this was before Starbucks was like ubiquitous with like, this is personal freedom.
Right, but now the notion of a latte, if you even mention a latte, it's almost
like,
as
drink
if.
Drink the latte.
Yeah, like, oh man, I didn't buy a Starbucks today and I'm still poor. Screw you, David Bach.
Yeah.
And then you get into like avocado couple toast conversations. Like, I
get it.
It
devolves everything.
Yeah. I think it's all a bit of a byproduct of, like, you know, millennial bashing and stuff like that. But yeah, at the end of the day, I would say do what works for you. If you don't like those people, you know, don't listen to them.
Well, you know what? Finance Buzz surveyed 1,200 U.S. adults in April of this year, April 2021, to better understand how prevalent financial advice is on social media and how it's affecting people's investing decisions. Hmm. And one of the questions they asked was, who do you trust for personal finance advice? 32% of people deemed Elon Musk, yes, Tesla Elon, to be extremely or very trustworthy for personal finance advice. But 33% said the same for Dave Ramsey. So there are a lot of people who put Dave Ramsey's expertise up there with Elon Musk, who one could argue has his own cult following and religion that is Tesla. So, you know, again, with a certain demographic, obviously the demographic answered these questions very similarly. With a certain demographic, that type of personality works.
Yeah, it makes me think of like fitness centers or like personal trainers or coaches. Like, they're not always going to give you feel good, soft, you know, encouraging words, right? Sometimes they might be in your face, like really trying to push you to be your best or to accomplish what you said you wanted to accomplish. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something that we know and recognize in sports. I think it's something that we might want to sort of recognize as relevant in maybe all areas of your life, right? Some of the best, most world-class and celebrated award-winning coaches, like, have a hot streak or a temper, and they lean into it sometimes to really get the best out of people. Not everyone is going to do that. Maybe you have a preference for someone that's going to be, I don't know why I'm thinking of Phil Jackson.
I was thinking of Phil Jackson.
Yeah,
too.
Who's like gonna, I forget what they call them, like, but like, like a Zen doctor or something like that. Maybe you want someone that's a bit more spiritual or stoic. It's all relevant, different styles, different strokes for different folks. But at the end of the day, like, you know, you've, the good news is you've got a variety of people that you can choose from. If you're looking for a coach or a certain style these days, there are all different types of people.
It makes me think of Ted Lasso, who is really in right now. But I can assure you that the world was not ready for that character like 5 years ago. If he had been introduced to us in the early, you know, 2020s, like the early mid 2015s.
Yeah.
I don't think our collective would have been ready. We thought he was kind of soft.
Yeah, he's truly like a breath of fresh air in the midst of a bunch of like hyper sensitivity and like just like really tumultuous times.
So yeah.
It was just like,
I think our collective opinion just about authority and expertise is changing. And so I'm welcoming the next voice, the next Dave Ramsey, the next iteration of Susie Orman or David Bach to like step to the mic. I'm sure the world will be ready for something different.
Yeah, I love it. All right, so let's wrap this up. I want to end with a couple more recommendations. So we gave one with respect to people who wanted to dig into or learn how to manage medical debt. We've got two other book recommendations for you. One I actually did not learn about until today. It's called You Are Your Best, Vulnerability, Shame, Resilience, and the Black Experience. You Are Your Best Thing, excuse me. It's by your favorite fellow Texan, Dr. Brené Brown and Tarana Burke.
Yes.
Yeah, they wrote this book. It's really, really cool. So as you mentioned, Brené Brown is a leading researcher, speaker, and writer on vulnerability. Tarana Burke is an activist most notably known for starting the Me Too movement. The book itself, I think, is like narrated by them, but it's a collection of essays from people sharing their experiences and overcoming shame from a Black perspective. And so if you're interested in wanting to dig deeper into shame and learning how to manage it, you might want to check that book out. The second one is a book that was actually sent to me by the writer. We've met her a few years ago. Her name is Lisa Peterson. The book that she wrote is called The Mindful Millionaire. I believe it came out last year. And she's basically leaning into her experience as a financial planner and a spiritual coach sort of into one book. And so she's sharing practices, compelling stories, and extensive research that can help people achieve their financial dreams. Lisa is an incredible woman. So happy to recommend that book for anyone who's looking for something that's a bit more spiritual or, dare I say, stoic. I apologize if I'm like leaning into areas that I am not an expert in, but I'm sort of borrowing that language because that's how I think about it. And so if that's something that you're interested in, dig in.
Yeah, I'll continue on. You know, that's my jam. So I'll continue and offer up The Four Agreements by Don Miguel Ruiz. It's called The Four Agreements, A Practical Guide to Personal Freedom. And it's one of those simple but powerful books that changes the way you approach your interactions. The Four Agreements, spoiler alert, are be impeccable with your word, don't take anything personally, don't make assumptions, and always do your best. And I reference it often because it just kind of exposes my self-limiting beliefs. And I think it sets the emotional groundwork that's necessary to tackle something as big and all-encompassing as shame and kind of address that feeling that you are bad versus this thing that you did or didn't do might be bad.
Yeah, yeah. It's really interesting. As I the more I'm thinking about this, like I feel like I need to carve out my own bit of time because, one, we're writing about this in a separate space. We're talking about it for this particular podcast. But I'm realizing even as we're having this conversation just how expansive and critical a topic of conversation shame is. Ooh. And how it really does have the tendency to define people's lives.
Yes.
All right.
Final thoughts.
Final thoughts. Why don't you kick us off?
So my final thought is that there are really practical ways to manage your debt. You've heard them before. Side hustles, refinancing, peer-to-peer lending, forgiveness programs. The point is, it can be managed even if it can't totally be paid off, or at least you think it can't totally be paid off in your lifetime. And so my final thought is that I encourage you to start thinking about yourself as the hero in your debt story instead of the villain. Changing your thoughts about your debt can have a profound effect on the quality of your life, and embracing that this is just part of your financial story changes how you think about yourself and what you can handle.
I love that. And I'm so glad that I know who you are, because I thought about writing or thinking about something similar to that, because I do think about shame and I do think about the story that we tell each other. But I wrote something a little differently because I knew or suspected that you would sort of lean into the idea of writing your own story. But I do believe that that's relevant. I think people have heard this before, but there is a common saying in the money world. It's a bit cliche, but I do think it's appropriate. And it's that your net worth is not your self-worth.
Yes.
And I think it's particularly applicable for this topic. And I think it works in both directions. So you're not better than anyone else because you have more money than them. Mm-hmm. And you aren't a bad person simply because you have debt, a negative net worth, or just having less money than someone that you're comparing yourself to is not a reason for personal crises or, right, you know, for you to sort of self-correct. You simply just need to build out a plan to help get rid of the debt. And let that be that. Everyone starts somewhere, and every valley I've come to learn is an opportunity to rise again. So stay the course, focus on the end goal, and never lose faith on what you can achieve when you focus and apply your energy.
Yes, you are very zen today. I'm gonna go light a candle and do some yoga.
Yeah, I haven't slept well.
Is that what it
is? Sleepiness. It's fatigue.
Well, thank you for listening to another episode of the Rich and Regular podcast presented by Success. You're not indebted to us, but if you want to do something nice and you like what you heard, please leave us a 5-star rating and review on the podcast page.
You know what? I'm pretty proud of us. We discussed shame and did not make a single Game of Thrones reference.
I couldn't have made one.
Oh, my goodness.
I know.
Shame on you.
See? We'll see y'all next week.